far, many of them women and children. The Israeli regime, encouraged by the United States and its Western allies and support, outlined three major objectives for this onslaught on Gaza. The Israeli regime has not only failed to achieve any of its goals, but also was forced to negotiate with the resistance movement Hamas on a ceasefire. The failure to achieve these goals has not only exposed the limitations of Israel's military prowess, but it has also highlighted the resilience and the determination of the Palestinian resistance forces. Osama Hamdan, Hamas's representative in Lebanon, said, "There is no doubt that Operation Al-Aqsa Flood represented a success for the resistance movement, a success in carrying out a large-scale operation without the enemy being able to take action preemptively." Osama Hamdan added, "This operation succeeded in seizing the entire Gaza positions within just hours. This is undoubtedly a great achievement, but there's the question, was there any expectation for the enemy's reaction? Certainly, it was expected that there would be a reaction, because it is the nature of the occupation. It kills you, seizes your land, arrests you, and imprisons you." Osama Hamdan added, "Under this occupation for 75 years, you have two choices. Either you do nothing and it continues to kill you, capture you and seize your land, or you resist and the enemy will continue the aggression." He added, "But the message will be conveyed that the Palestinian people are still adhering to the right to resist, that the enemy is paying a price for its occupation." The English website of the Mehr News Agency has also covered the same story and tells us more. Operation Al-Aqsa Flood marked a significant turning point for the Palestinian people, showcasing the harsh reality of Israeli occupation to the world. This operation not only highlighted the plight of Palestinians, but also indicated the power of Palestinian resistance in a coastal territory which has been under siege for the past 17 years. Prior to Operation Al-Aqsa Flood, Arab countries were moving towards normalizing their ties with Israel, overshadowing the Palestinian cause. However, the Gaza war that followed the 7th of October operation has shifted global attention back to the long-standing struggle of the Palestinian people for their freedom over the past seven decades. It's been a stark reminder of the brutality of the Israeli occupation. Despite Israel's military might and reputation, the war in Gaza has been perceived as a humiliating defeat for Israel on multiple fronts. Public opinion worldwide has increasingly turned against Israel as images of civilian casualties and destruction in Gaza have circulated widely, shedding light on the brutality of the Israeli military, which has left no safe zone in Gaza. Even hospitals and United Nations refugee shelters in Gaza have been hit. The 7th of October operation is a testament to the power of Palestinian resistance, showcasing how a small and determined movement can withstand the might of the Israeli army, which is backed by the United States and many other Western countries. This operation highlighted the unwavering resilience of the Palestinian people and emphasized that resistance is not only a means of survival, but also a powerful tool in securing the right to self-determination of the Palestinian people.
On Islam.
Assalamu alaikum. Peace be upon you and welcome to Eye on Islam, the show where we look at current affairs through an Islamic lens. Ever since October the 7th, Muslims have been united in their support for Palestine and the people of Gaza. This unity has manifested itself in protests and other civil actions to oppose the genocidal Zionist entity. Soraya Quds resistance spokesman Abu Hamza recently gave thanks to the resistance actors for their efforts in helping the people of Palestine. But sadly, some within the Sunni world took issue with that, exposing sectarian tendencies and in some cases even siding with the Zionists against what they see as a Shia-led movement. On this week's episode, we will explore questions around unity and what the populations and nations of the Islamic world have done to stand for Palestine, and how Muslims should be tamping down sectarian tensions at such a crucial time instead of exacerbating them. But first, let's take a look at how leaders of the Palestinian resistance themselves have cherished the sacrifices of the Islamic Republic of Iran over the years, as well as those of its allies in the region.
The relationship between the Islamic Republic of Iran and the Palestinian people has been strong ever since the Islamic Revolution in 1979. But in the last two decades or so, the ties have only intensified on a political, financial, and military level. And this is a fact not lost on Palestinian resistance leaders who have repeatedly gone out of their way to praise the principled stance taken by the Islamic Republic. Back in 2014, when the Gazan resistance was fighting the Zionist occupation, Abu Obaida, the spokesman of Al-Qassim Brigades, thanked Iran in no uncertain terms for their support for the resistance. A few years later, the leader of Hamas in Gaza, Yahya Sinwar, also praised Iran and slammed neighboring Arab countries for abandoning the Palestinian cause. And since the 7th of October, the leaders of the resistance groups on the ground have also been active in praising the resistance axis, with the most recent speech by Abu Hamza of Soraya Quds catching many people's attention, which merely highlights and reaffirms the ties between Palestine and the rest of the resistance axis across West Asia, and most crucially, the Islamic Republic of Iran.
To discuss this important topic are two very special guests. Joining us is Saida Emin Mousavi, an up-and-coming political analyst and writer with a master's degree in international conflict studies from King's College London. We also have Latifa Abu Shakra, who is the granddaughter of survivors of the Palestinian Nakba. Thank you so much to you both for joining us. Sister Latifa, let me just begin with yourself. We've heard that clip there, going back many years, decades even, into the relationship between the Palestinians and their resistance movements and those of the Islamic Republic of Iran and the resistance axis. How is public opinion today in Palestine when it comes to Islamic unity? Is there a stress on prioritizing Islamic unity over theological differences? And do you think the recent genocide in Gaza has led to an increase in that focus on unity?
So one of the things that we definitely need to understand is prior to this genocide, you know, we had incredible leaders within the Palestinian resistance, like Nizar Banat, Shahid Nizar Banat, Allah yirhamu, who was, you know, in 2021 was actually talking about the fact that these sectarian differences don't serve us, and actually the Shia are the one who have constantly been providing the resistance in Palestine with the resources that they need to keep up the battle. And this was in 2021. This was prior to you know, what we're seeing now in the past 6 months. But now, if you're asking me also what's happening now since the genocide occurred, it was only a few days ago when Iran launched their masterstroke attack that we saw Gazans on the ground shouting out Ya Hussein and Ya Ali and Labayka Ya Khamenei. And these are definite signs of changes in theological differences, in theological unity now within the people in Palestine. But it doesn't mean that the political unity doesn't also exist. So to answer your question, yes, there has definitely been a shift prior to the genocide in Gaza, but more so now, absolutely. We see the people within Gaza changing their entire mindset. They are rethinking their theology even, because they are seeing that the people who stand with them have unfortunately only been the Shia in practice.
And it's interesting because I've seen videos earlier on during the genocide where you had people in Palestine saying, we were lied to, we were told the Houthis were bad, Ansar Allah were bad, we were told Hezb al-Sha'bi were a sectarian militia, we were told that Hezbollah were called Hezb al-Shaytan, and all of these types of terms, mainly because of, you know, differences and tensions around the Syria conflict, but elsewhere. And then they said, now we've seen, in our time of need, who it is who's actually stood with the Palestinian people and who's just abandoned us to our fate, so to speak. So there is that shift. Sister Emin, some parties are, as we can see, trying to revive this question of sectarianism, maybe to draw Muslims away from supporting the axis of resistance and the philosophy of resistance. And in light of Iran's operation over the recent period, we see that that's maybe intensifying as well. Is this maybe to cover up for the shortcomings of those people, as we heard Palestinians saying, we've been abandoned? And maybe there's a bit of guilt there, so they're trying to distract people from that. And also, do you think this sectarianism is organic, or are there other vested interests trying to astroturf this type of sentiment amongst Muslims?
So, definitely. I think we first need to establish that sectarianism is a tool of the West. It was created to fragment us, to divide us, to weaken the ummah. It's not something that's inherent in the Muslim ummah. It's something that is planted. You can kind of think of it as a colonial seed, if you will. And how does this colonial seed benefit the imperial powers of today? Well, it keeps us from upholding a united resistance, which is the occupation's biggest threat. And we know this because, like Latifa mentioned, some of the most valuable people were targeted and martyred by the occupation, killed in cold blood, like Saleh al-Aruri, like Nizar Banat, these people who said that we cannot afford to fragment the movement. We cannot afford to isolate Palestine, the resistance in Palestine, from the wider anti-imperial shifts in the region. We must unite, and we must see that logistically, militarily, financially, the benefit in uniting. And when Muslims buy into this sectarian narrative that's designed to handicap us, it's also important to mention that it affects the quality of your analysis of the situation. So recently we had the Iranian attack, and there was a lot of comments on this all being a display of theatrics. Iran wasn't actually motivated by a need to help or a need to respond, but just to create some chaos, just to instill itself for the sake of it. And that's despite the fact that the Islamic Republic has committed itself to the support of the Palestinian movement, the Palestinian liberation and resistance since its inception. It's provided military, logistic, financial support to it. And
I find it interesting, sorry to cut you off, because some people said, oh, they were only responding because their embassy got hit.
Yeah.
But the counter to that is, well, their consulate got hit because they have generals in that conflict.
Exactly.
And those generals are there helping the Palestinian resistance and the resistance axis. They wouldn't have been there in the first place if it wasn't because of the cause of Palestine. Mm. So I think people need to draw out from that very narrow way of analysing it, have a more holistic thing. And the question of sectarianism, I want to quickly put it to you as well, is, of course, there is a lot of maybe anti-Shia sectarianism, but even within the Shia community, there is an attempt to maybe make people apathetic to the question of Palestine and say, oh, it's not our cause, it's a Sunni cause, it's got nothing to do with Shia Muslims. What's it got to do with us anyway? Like, we're not involved. And in a way, that can sometimes be, while it's a very, very small minority view, it can still be a very dangerous attempt to try to draw support away from the resistance axis. Do you have any kind of view on that side of things as well?
Yeah, so I think that really comes down to it, that the fact that sectarianism is planted. It's not inherent in our faith. It's not inherent for Shias. It's not inherent for Sunnis. It's planted. It's an imperial invention. And when you understand that, these narratives simply just dissipate. They don't have any relevance to the conversation. Mm. And like I was saying, even Iran itself, it has been an open obstacle to the imperial interests in the region, more so than a lot of countries like Turkey, like Egypt, like Jordan. You know, it's presented itself not as a Shia nation trying to instill Shia Islam, but
as a nation that is committed to liberation, committed to an anti-imperial trajectory for the region. And as Muslims, we need to make sure that we're not dragged into the sectarian narrative, to the sectarian square, because that's exactly what the enemies want us to do. That's exactly what the occupation entity wants. And we've even seen this recently, the
Security Council.
Yeah, so we also saw it with, what is it? I forgot his name. His name sits in my mind. I think it was Odin, the Israeli representative to the UN, where he basically peddled the same sectarian narrative. Yeah. He said that Iran is simply, it doesn't
attacking
care about Islam.
Aqsa and the, we're defending
it. He also said things like, Iran is just concerned with spreading Shiism in the region.
Yeah.
You know, so we really need to ask ourselves, what is this ideology serving?
Yeah.
Who is it serving?
And we've seen it before as well from the Arabic service of the Israelis as well, literally pushing this kind of sectarian narrative that in many ways doesn't differ from the Takfiri narrative as well. But now we can take maybe a closer look at the strategic vision of Operation Truthful Promise, whereby Iran responded directly against Israeli territory for the heinous terrorist attack that the Zionist entity committed against the Iranian consulate in Damascus.
On the 1st of April, the Israeli occupation entity bombed the Iranian consulate in Damascus in a clear violation of international law. The entire world waited and anticipated a response from Iran, and after 10 days, gave the Israeli occupation an ultimatum: stop the aggression in Gaza, and the response will not be as harsh. On the 13th of April, Iran sends the Israeli occupation entity another warning by seizing their ship, in doing so demonstrating their strength. A day later, Iran announced the launch of over 300 missiles and bone-shattering drones into Israel. Some have claimed that the Iranian response was performative, but the message of deterrence that Iran sent was loud and clear and achieved several objectives. This was the longest-range attack in history, an incredible feat for a country under brutal sanctions for the past 40 years. The Israeli occupation entity's economy took a catastrophic hit. According to their sources, their failed air defense systems cost them $1.35 billion, exhausting over 60% of the Zionist entity's military monthly budget, not accounting for the cost for their allies, Jordan, UK, and France. Iran managed to break the prestige of the Israeli occupation entity and expose its fragility, a strategic defeat and a humiliating failure, as it was unable to protect itself by itself. The settler population, upon which the entity relies to legitimize its occupation, fled for their lives, knowing for certain their genocidal government cannot protect them, instead arming them to attack Palestinians in and around their illegal settlements. After such a humiliating blow, the Knesset declared that they would respond. However, their sponsor, the U.S., made it clear that they will not support an attack on Iran as it cannot sustain an all-out war. The Israeli occupation entity has now opened five fronts on itself. One, the Lebanese front. Two, the Yemeni front, where the Yemenis already hold the occupation entity's economy in a chokehold. 3. The Iraqi front. 4. The Syrian front. And now they've opened the fifth front, which is with Iran. It is likely for the front with Iran, the resistance axis has one goal in mind. Their warning is very clear: stop the assault on Gaza, and the attacks on the Israeli occupation entity will also be halted. The undertone of their actions has always been: the Palestinians must liberate Palestine.
Now, if I could go to the Operation Truthful Promise, and I'll begin with yourself, Sister Emin, in terms of your thoughts. What were your thoughts in the wake of Iran's retaliation for that unprecedented and illegal attack on their consulate building in Damascus?
The Iranian attack was masterful on many different levels. It was strategically successful. For example, the first point is that we've moved now. This is an indication that we've moved from an era of Israeli attacks against Iranian generals, Iranian sovereignty without a harsh response. That era is over, and that's because Iran has established a new deterrence equation, which is that any form of aggression from the entity will be met with equal, if not more, force to quell it. And that kind of, you know, indicates this shift from strategic patience to deterrence. And, you know, Iran is also now a direct front. It's a direct supporting front, like that of Yemen, like that of Lebanon. It's still slightly different because it is the leader of the Axis. Mm-hmm. So it functions on a slightly different level. But the significance of that is that Iran will not hesitate to attack, whether that be Israeli ships, whether that be bases, even in the heart of the occupation entity. And the brilliance of this strategy was that it attacked while also navigating a minefield of considerations. Mm. It had to make sure that it didn't move attention away from Gaza, that it didn't limit in any way its ability or harm its ability to provide military logistical support to the wider resistance. It also, the biggest thing it needed to consider was that it didn't want to bring in the US into this war, which is exactly what Israel wanted when it attacked the consulate in Syria. Mm. It wanted to save face through hiding behind the US. So if Iran had failed on any one of these fronts, it would have essentially handed the occupation entity the upper hand. Mm. And it succeeded in not doing that.
Yeah.
I think it was also a demonstration of capabilities as well. It was also an opportunity to amass intelligence for any future escalations. Now Iran knows which states will go and run to support the aggressor.
Mm.
How many of them will? When will they?
Mm.
What kind of deterrence methods will they try and use? Mm. How, when, and what locations
and
will they use it from?
According to a lot of reports, Iran didn't use its most modern weapons. It
exactly.
used a lot of the oldest new drones that it's got, and not the newer ones. It used older missiles and so on. So a warning there as well, that maybe if you do push the wrong buttons, we will bring out our new technology, which you clearly won't have defenses for, because the older ones did manage to get through. Sister Latifa, what are your thoughts on that operation from last week?
I couldn't have said it better. I think there is something that we do need to talk about in terms of the change of the strategic calculus
Sure.
of the region with Iran that has now taken a more aggressive and assertive posture within the region. And that is that it went, as Emin was saying, from a strategic patience perspective, where it was allowing its generals to be killed, or allowing maybe isn't the right word, but it was
tolerating
the aggressions,
the hits, yeah.
absorbing
yeah.
the hits, a little bit like Black Panther's suit, and now you know, unleashing all that force. And it needed to do that, as Emin was saying, because there was a lot that needed to be learnt before they could attack Israel. We need to remember that 6 months ago, it's hard to think now, but Israel 6 months ago was this untouchable, you know, incredible entity in the region, you know, a giant that that nobody dared to even speak against, let alone act against. For it now to be this shriveling entity, rightly so, in its place, is all down to Iran and its change of posturing, which has now gone into the deterrence mode, willing to attack, showing that they are truly the maddest in the room, willing to sacrifice. Martyrs are ready at the borders to go. The people of Iran are waiting for a fatwa from their maraja so that they can go and fight. And if this is the everyday man and woman of Iran, you can imagine the people who have been trained for years watching the massacre of the people of Gaza and the people in Palestine, the humiliation that they have had to suffer for the past 76 years. You know, these are things that are being taught to the people of Iran since childhood. So their love and their passion for the Palestinians exceeds the love of their own nation even. And this deterrence posturing is not a front. They have the weapons, they have the allies, they have built on it for decades, and it will well, we've seen that it has had an impact on the region, and it will continue to do so.
And it's interesting because that deterrence, as you mentioned, has been there since before, you know, October the 7th. It was to the point where most of the countries of the region were on the brink, well, I say most, but some of the most important ones, like Saudi, there were reports of normalization with Israel. And all of a sudden now we're in a situation where that's likely off the table. And in fact, countries like Saudi and others, despite their close military ties with the Western nations, are distancing themselves and saying, well, we didn't have anything to do with it. It was only Jordan, from all the countries in the region, which went out of its way to support the entity. Sister Emin, if we could come to you finally, just briefly, I want to talk about some of those countries. You've got countries like Turkey, which, you know, Erdogan speaks about the Palestinians and supports them, and yet hasn't cut ties with Israel, continues to trade with them, send them food and gas and other utilities and items, I believe. And of course, Jordan, as we just mentioned, going even further and shooting down munitions, injuring some of their own people in the process. What are your thoughts on that? Why have they done this? Why are they not still, even after this genocide, cutting their ties with Israel?
Well, to put it very simply, they're allies of the occupation entity. They're allies of the US. They are in the camp of the aggressors. They are normalizers. So, for example, you mentioned Turkey. Turkey is a member of NATO. Turkey is a US ally. Turkey is one of the biggest exporters to Israel. And Jordan, when Ansar Allah was, you know, seizing these Israeli ships in the Red Sea, it was actually through Jordan and Saudi and the UAE that these routes were being rerouted through. So, and also with Jordan, we can't forget the Iranian attack. It positioned itself with the aggressors. It helped in downing the missiles that the Iranians were kind of inflicting on the occupation entity. And I think even prior to this war, they house the imperial powers in the region. They give a leg for it to stand on. Look at Western bases. Where are they all surrounding? They're surrounding Turkey, the Gulf states. And so really, we understand that all this these pro-Palestinian words, they're just talk. It's just talk, and it's designed to appease the people, because at least these nations are a little smart enough to know that the people side with Palestine. That is the popular sentiment. And it's safe to say that these normalizing entities did not think that this war would go on for so long. They did not think that we would have so much time to see the hypocrisy in their stance and the difference between their words and their actions.
Absolutely. And thank you, Sister Sayyida Emin, for your wonderful analysis and contributions, and yourself as well, Sister Latifa. Always interesting as well to get it from the perspective of a Palestinian on such a key issue at a key moment. And we'd also like to thank you at home. Sadly, that is all we have time for today, but you can join us again next week for another edition of Eye on Islam. Assalamu alaikum.
A diverse range of programs. Youth. Spirituality. Culture. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
A potential US ban against TikTok took a major step towards becoming reality on Saturday, 20th of April, as House lawmakers approved a hot-button bill targeting the app. We take a look at the US media's coverage of this story. The national broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. The House of Representatives passed legislation on Saturday, 20th of April, that would ban TikTok in the United States if the popular social media platform's China-based owner doesn't sell its stake within a year. But don't expect the app to go away anytime soon. The decision by House Republicans to include TikTok as part of a larger foreign aid package, a priority for President Joe Biden, with broad congressional support, fast-tracked the ban after an earlier version had stalled in the U.S. Senate. A standalone bill with a six-month selling deadline passed the House in March by an overwhelming bipartisan vote, as both Democrats and Republicans voiced national security concerns about the app's owner, the Chinese technology firm ByteDance Limited. The modified measure passed by 360 votes in favor, 58 votes against, and now goes to the Senate after negotiations that produced a compromise. Even if the legislation becomes law, though, the company would have up to a year to find a buyer and would likely try to challenge the law in courts of law, arguing it would deprive the app's millions of users of their First Amendment rights. Court challenges could significantly delay the timeline set by Congress or block the law from going into effect. The company lobbied hard against the legislation, pursuing the app's 170 million U.S. users, many of whom are young people, to call Congress and voice opposition. But the ferocity of the pushback angered lawmakers on Capitol Hill, where there is broad concern about Chinese threats to U.S. national security and where few members use the platform themselves. "We will not stop fighting and advocating for you," TikTok's chief executive officer, Xu Zhiqiu, said in a video that was posted on the platform last month and directed towards the app's users. "We will continue to do all we can, including exercising our legal rights to protect this amazing platform that we have built with you." The bill's quick path through U.S. Congress is extraordinary because it targets one company and because Congress has taken a hands-off approach to technology regulation for decades. Lawmakers have failed to act despite efforts to protect children online, safeguard users' privacy, and make companies more liable for content posted on their platforms, among other measures. The TikTok ban reflects widespread concerns from lawmakers about China. Members of both political parties, along with intelligence officials, have worried that Chinese authorities could force ByteDance to hand over American user data or direct the company to suppress or boost TikTok content favorable to its interests. TikTok has denied assertions that it could be used as a tool by the Chinese government and has said it has not shared U.S. user data with Chinese authorities. The U.S. government has not publicly provided evidence that shows TikTok shared U.S. user data with the Chinese government or tinkered with the company's popular algorithm, which influences what Americans see. The company has good reason to think a legal challenge could be successful, having seen some success in previous legal fights over its operations in the United States. Last November, a federal judge blocked a Montana law that would ban TikTok users across the state after the company and five content creators who use the platform sued. In 2020, federal courts blocked an executive order issued by then-President Donald Trump to ban TikTok after the company sued on the grounds that the order violated free speech and due process rights. Trump administration brokered a deal that would have had U.S. corporations Oracle and Walmart take a large stake in TikTok. The sale never went through for a number of reasons. One was China, which imposed stricter export controls on its technology providers. Dozens of states and the federal government have put in place TikTok bans on government devices. Texas's ban was challenged last year by the Knight First Amendment Institute at Columbia University, which argued in a lawsuit that the policy was impeding academic freedom because it extended to public universities. In December, a federal judge ruled in favor of the state. Organizations such as the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU, have backed the app. Congress cannot take away the rights of over 170 million Americans who use TikTok to express themselves, engage in political advocacy, and access information from around the world, according to Jenna Leventhoff, a lawyer for the ACLU. CNN cable news network has also covered the same story. A potential U.S. ban against TikTok took a major step towards becoming reality on Saturday, 20th of April, as House lawmakers approved a hot-button bill targeting the app as part of a wider-ranging aid package. The bipartisan vote of 360 in favor, 58 votes against, marks the latest defeat for TikTok in Washington, as the embattled social media company with 170 million American users fights for survival under its current ownership by ByteDance, its Chinese parent company. The bill passed by the House this weekend closely resembles an earlier version approved in March of this year that would ban TikTok from U.S. app stores unless it finds a new owner and quickly. By attaching the TikTok bill to funding for Ukrainian military equipment, House Republicans put the pressure on U.S. Senate lawmakers to consider the whole package in a single up or down vote. Policy analysts expect the Senate to take up the aid package quickly, giving it high odds of passage. And President Joe Biden has previously said he would sign the TikTok legislation if it reaches his desk. The fast-tracking of the TikTok bill shows how policy priorities outside of the company's control have merged to create a potent and potentially devastating outcome for an app that's beloved by many young Americans, and that U.S. officials say is a national security risk. The version of the bill approved on Saturday, 20th of April, would, if signed, give TikTok 270 days to find a new owner, up from the roughly 6 months contemplated under prior versions of the legislation. And the bill also gives the White House an option to extend that deadline another 90 days if President Biden determines that progress towards a sale has been made. TikTok has vocally opposed the bill. For weeks, TikTok has waged an intense lobbying campaign in a bid to defeat the legislation, arguing it violates its users' First Amendment rights and threatens small businesses. It is unfortunate that the House of Representatives is using the cover of important foreign and humanitarian assistance to once again jam through a ban bill that would trample upon the free speech rights of 170 million Americans, devastate 7 million businesses, and shutter a platform that contributes $24 billion to the U.S. economy annually. TikTok has hinted it could sue to block the House's divestiture legislation, telling users in March that it plans to continue fighting, including by exercising our legal rights. A court challenge over the law would set the stage for a high-stakes battle over Americans' right to access digital information. Until this week, Senate lawmakers have been divided over the House's proposal for a forced sale of TikTok. That shifted somewhat once the House unveiled its latest draft, featuring a longer deadline. And in the days leading up to the House vote, on Saturday, 20th of April, Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer emphasized the urgency of approving the foreign aid bill. On Saturday, Chuck Schumer said in remarks on the Senate floor that there is a tentative agreement for the chamber to take up the foreign aid package on Tuesday.
conversation.
Hello, I'm Jim Gibney, and welcome to a special edition of The Conversation, where we take an alternative look at political events and current affairs around Ireland. This week, we take a look at the 1981 hunger strike. Much has been written about this tumultuous period in our history. But one area which has not received much attention is the communication system used by both the leadership of Sinn Féin on the outside and the prisoners on the inside. So let's introduce today's guests. Joining me today is Tom Hartley, who's in charge of the POW department and organised the communication system from the outside. I'm also joined today by former political prisoner Sheena Walsh, who can speak authoritatively about the communication from inside the H-blocks during the hunger strike of 1981. And firstly then, over to Tom. So Tom, first of all, why was there a communication system needed and when did you put it together? When did you organise it?
Well, of course, the prison authorities done all in their power to close down the communications between the prisoners and the outside. And that meant, of course, that there wasn't a flow and it was often difficult to get information in and out of the jail. And, of course, men were, and women in the Armagh, they were locked away. They were on strike. They were on the no-wash. And all of that, these conditions made it difficult to have a flow of information in and out of the jail, or indeed all of it made it difficult to have a flow of communications. So I was appointed head of the POW department sometime, I think about, was 1979, 1980. And of course, the context for all of this is a very deepening crisis in the H-blocks in Armagh Women's Prison. And so I was appointed as the chair of the POW department. And the first thing I set myself to do was to create a communications between us outside and the prisoners inside. Because it was obvious that we needed a flow of information. Because the period we were going through was, you know, it was a deep political crisis.
When you say a crisis, what exactly do you mean in terms of the, how many prisoners were you dealing with on the inside in the H-blocks and in Armagh Women's Prison?
Well, I think by that time there was a few hundred. Remember, there was always an increasing number of prisoners and it was never a static number. And so you had the prisoners in the H-blocks and the women in Armagh jail. And but what was really going on was this big, you know, crisis inside the jails. It was really imperative that the leadership outside had an understanding of the conditions inside, what the Republican prisoners were enduring, what was happening to them, you know, and what was happening to them on a daily basis. So I went then to see Maura McCrory, and Maura was in charge of the Relatives Action Committee. And so I explained to Maura what was required in terms of communication. Now, Maura then went to the Relatives Action Committee, and the Relatives Action Committee was made up of the girlfriends, mothers, sisters, grandmothers of the prisoners. And so Maura then brought me back a list of those who were going to visit. So that was really the start of a process where we could determine who was going to what block, who was going to Armagh, and then we started to send, started to build this communication network with the prisoners. And in time, of course, the prisoners then sent us the what visits they were taking. So, in fact, there was a coordinated approach between ourselves and the prisoners to create this flow of information and flow of comms in and out of the jails.
That might be a good point to bring Shane in to explain from the inside, the prison point of view, why it was important that there was this flow of information from inside to outside.
I would have to actually go back a wee bit because whenever the protests started in September 76 with Keir Nugent, the vast majority of the prisoners who ended up in the protest refused to take visits because it meant that you would have to wear a prison uniform. So what that then meant was that people didn't know what was happening outside because our letters were being censored, heavily censored, and any information that we could get out usually was word of mouth through the priests who were coming in. Or when we shared it across, you met people from, if you had to go to the hospital or you had to go on appeals or, you know, to go back to court, things like that. That is the only time that you would actually come across other prisoners and be able to get the word out. So it was late 77, early 78. When Brent Hughes and the team came down from the cages, having lost their status as a result of an incident that happened, a bit of a row with the prison warders in the cages, and they landed down into the blocks. And one of the first things that the dark made clear to people was that people outside didn't know what was going on inside the prisons. They didn't know about the brutality and the deprivation that we were enduring. And so he also initiated a discussion and a debate about the future of the protest. And that actually started then on March 1978. What actually happened was when we took the decision to take visits, it meant that you were coming into more and more contact with the prison warders. And the prison warders resented the fact that we were taking visits, and they stepped up the harassment and the brutality, which then led in turn to us beginning to escalate the protests within the jail, which in turn led to further escalation of the brutality. And we ended up on the No Wash protest. We used to take visits with a simple objective of getting the word out of what was happening within the prisons. It was only later then that we decided that we were going to have to organise it in some better fashion, because initially it was very haphazard. You took visits whenever you wanted to take them or whenever it suited your family. We decided that we would have to start taking a more strategic approach to it, because we needed to spread the visits out, whereby we were trying to cover every single day that there would be visits out from every wing and visits, you know, making contact with not only the our visitors, but also making contact with prisoners from the other blocks.
So there's an awareness on the inside that there has to be a much more coordinated approach to get the information outside to Tom and to the party leadership. And then, so Tom, what then happens with this system? You've got a group of women who are basically organised around yourself. What then begins to take shape in terms of the structure? Well, of the communication
first
system.
Of all, it's a very simple system, you know. There's nothing extraordinary about it other than there were visits, and then the prisoners were sending out their information, and we were sending in information. So once that was established, that really took off and just worked on its own. And it was, that was a pattern, you know, that's right through the hunger strikes and right beyond the hunger strikes, that this communication trail was established and then worked. But from early on, certainly when I started to communicate with the prisoners, one of the first things I did was to send in a note, quite a lengthy note, to say, look, you need then to start to write to the Archbishop of Canterbury, the Pope, the Taoiseach, your GAA clubs, your youth clubs, your women's movement, any social connection that was in existence needed to get a note or a letter from a H-Block prisoner or a woman in Armagh. And in essence, what then happened was, so prisoners, of course, were on the inside, you might say, you know, really at the coal face of the struggle. But then the role as communicating their conditions to the outside world really externalized the role, you know, so it wasn't that they were, this was an internalized role of prisoners by and large watching what was happening to their comrades in hunger strike. I think suddenly prisoners had this very structured view of what they needed to do to inform the world. You know that old Republican saying, it's no use doing it if you don't tell the world. So the prisoners told the world by the sending out their comms.
So Shana, in terms of inside the prison, who was coordinating that huge effort that Tom is describing?
Well, it would actually have to go back before the hunger strikes again, and in the sense that late 79, there was a push on by the prisoners for a hunger strike. It was actually at the time of the Pope visiting Ireland. In October 79, the Pope came. But before that, there had been the intention to launch a hunger strike. And what then happened was that after some very forthright discussion with the leadership on the outside, the prisoners, they agreed to defer the protest, the hunger strike, and to engage in a whole propaganda campaign, basically, of information, as relayed by Tom there. That we then began to write to everybody that we could think of. Trade unions, GAA groups, credit union organisations, community groups, anybody who we thought would give us an ear. We also wrote to all sorts of politicians, both foreign and domestic. We wrote to any sort of big personalities. Like I remember Bobby Sands talking about writing to Jane Fonda. And Jane Fonda actually made some comment in one of the Sunday papers about receiving this this call from the prisons in Ireland and in Loughcash. So we really sort of got stuck into that from about 1979, late 1979.
In terms of then, because obviously, I think Shana was saying that there was phases to this. You know, there's this what he called the propaganda phase leading up to the hunger strike. And at that stage, the flow of information from your end into the prison was routine and in a way casual. But as the situation deteriorates in the prison, you then have the hunger strike of 1980 looming. What then happens to the system, the communication system?
Well, let me explain then how the communications were handled outside. First of all, we would send a communication in at 9:30 in the morning, and we were able to get an answer out by 12:30. And then we were able to send another communication in at about 2:00 and get a reply now by, say, 4:00 or 4:30. And that was fairly standard, you know, that so that that once that was established, that was the pattern, you know, that so we had very good communications. And then as we developed and as the crisis developed, there was small crystal radios sent in. Now, they were so small, but the benefit of the crystal radio was that the blocks were beside the BBC mast at Blurs, so they could pick up the news. So right. That was a help to them. So they were able to hear what was taking place, say, at the 11 o'clock news at night. That was also an aid. Then we decided that we would miniaturise the Infoblocked. And they were about that size. And they were sent in. So there was an intense level of communication going in. Now, what would happen? There was, at one level, there was thousands of communications coming out. And we could not handle all the communications. So generally, we handled the communications to the leadership of Sinn Féin coming out. And we had a room in 51 Falls Road. And so as the communications came out, they would all be sorted. And then we had a team that would write out and then type out on small brown sheets of paper what was in the comm. And these would be presented to the leadership.
You know, one of the things that I always think about is the quote from Pat Sheehan. Pat Sheehan was on the hunger strike for 55 days. He was the longest prisoner on the hunger strike whenever the hunger strike was ended on the 3rd of October in 1981. And Pat talks about whenever he put his name down to go on the hunger strike, that he received a call from the IRA, from the Army Council of the IRA. And what it stated on the call, on the cover of the call, the address of the call, it said on it, Oglach Pat Sheehan. And Pat was saying that, you know, the only time you ever see a reference to Oglach anybody is on a gravestone.
Mm-hmm.
And he said that this had a very profound effect upon him when he received this call from the council.
And do you recall the crystal radios coming into the prison? Was there one in your wing?
The crystal radios, the introduction of the crystal radios was massive in the blocks, because up until then, the news that we got was through the visits the sort of weekly news that you would have got from the Republican News whenever we were able to smuggle in. And the crystal sets really changed all that, in that you were able to get a daily news every night. Now, as we got further into the hunger strike, and particularly as the situation became more and more intense, guys used to listen to the radios during the day. So you have cases where, and it was very dangerous to do that, in the sense that the prison warders could come and open your door at any time. But we were so hungry for news, so eager to keep on top of what was happening to our comrades in the hospitals, listening to any news of the various initiatives that we were getting. You know, various, Thomas talked about the external groups who were coming up with ways of how to solve the hunger strike, in terms of the Irish Commission for Justice and Peace. There was a delegation of Southern MEPs came in. There were people come in from the Swiss Red Cross guys come in and visited us at one stage with, you know, looking at different ways to resolve it. There was a constant flow of bishops and you know, the Pope actually sent an emissary across to try and resolve the hunger strike. So all of this was happening, and it was very important